This podcast is a quest for well-being, a quest for a meaningful life through the exploration of fundamental truth. Enlightening ideas, insights on physical, mental, and spiritual health. The inspiration is love. The aspiration is to awaken new ways of thinking that can lead us to a new way of being. Being well. Welcome to Body, Mind, and Soul Healing Conversations.
Beautifully broken, soul stripped bare, fragmented heart, pain and despair. Tears will cleanse from deep inside, wounded by love, tormented by mind. Beautifully broken, seems so unfair. Spirit is strengthened through love and care. Life and its meaning is yours to decide. Emotional scars that will forever bind. Beautifully broken, so now you know. Journey on, may you reap what you sow. Sword is strengthened by the heat of flame. Beautifully broken, there's no one to blame. By Ray Sinclair. Valeria interviews Dr. Lisa Billings. She received her PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Virginia. While there, her research focused on how traumatic childhood experiences affect individuals' developmental trajectories. Specifically, Lisa focused on the long-term and insidious effects of interparental conflict, divorce, and family violence on well-being, as well as how divorce mediation can enhance post-divorce family functioning. Dr. Billings has published several journal articles in these areas and did a postdoctoral fellowship, thinking she would go into academia like everyone else in her family. Her father was a professor for over 50 years at the University of Chicago. Her stepmother was an academic medicine at Northwestern. One of her brothers is a physics professor at Boston University, and the other brother is a neuroscience professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Once Lisa began having children, however, she understood a few things more deeply. Number one, being a good mom to her children was one of her primary reasons for being on this earth. And number two, being a guide and a healer to others was her other primary purpose. Lisa strongly believes that the loss and trauma she experienced in childhood has given her special powers of empathy and insight. After spending 8 more years at Children's Hospital and having 4 children, Lisa started her private practice in Central Denver just over 15 years ago. In her private practice, she specializes in the transition to adulthood, anxiety, depression, complex childhood trauma, divorce, and other difficult life transitions. In addition to traditional talk therapy, she has also been trained in psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy and currently provides ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, KAP, in her office. There is now a strong body of peer-reviewed literature that demonstrate both the neuroscientific benefits of ketamine on the brain, decreases depression, suicidality, and increases neuroplasticity, as well as the enhanced benefits of using ketamine as a catalyst to therapy, especially with individuals struggling with anxiety, depression, and trauma, e.g. the rigid thinking disorders. Lisa has seen the incredible benefits of KAP with her own eyes with clients in her practice. In addition to her private practice, Dr. Billings recently joined Nomotherapy, a startup KAP company, which will provide a specially curated 14-week KAP program to those diagnosed with depression, anxiety, or trauma-related disorders. Nomotherapy is already contracted with Colorado Medicaid, as well as most major insurance companies, so the benefits of KAP will be more accessible to a broader range of clientele. Meet Dr. Lisa at drlisabillings.com. Here's the interview with Dr. Lisa Billings.
In your own words, who is Lisa?
Yeah, that's such a
a great and complicated question.
Yes.
I honestly feel, and I don't know if this is going to set women back, and but whatever, honestly, I feel at the core, I am a mother. Like, that has been something that has been, like, the most important sort of goal and, I guess, privilege that I've been given. And it's something that I yearned for since I was very young. I think recognizing, like, early on that I was in a childhood that was not what I wanted and not, like, what I expected or fit in, what, you know, that I could not wait to be able to sort of, you know, sort of have to produce a family of my own and to be able to be a mother and be a guide, you know, a guide, a nurturer, a lover, someone who can just really help make you the best person you can be, you know, all those things were just, and so I remember early, actually, this is a very early memory at 7 or 8. It was right when my family of origin was really falling apart, walking up and down the sort of department store aisles and looking at baby clothes and just dreaming about my family.
So that is a
big part of me. Other parts, because I think we're all made up of lots of parts. I am a clinical psychologist. I was trained as a scientist practitioner, got my PhD in clinical psychology at University of Virginia. And I'm very much, as you were saying earlier, like, I'm very much about informing what I do with research and with looking at, you know, the scientific rigor of how a problem is approached and how we're going to think about it and how we're, you know, and what the outcomes are and all that before I decide how I'm going to sort of approach the problem in front of me. And so I love the research that I did over my graduate years and postdoctoral years. And I probably even more love my clients that I work with and all the people that I've been privileged to sort of walk along their paths with. And so in that way, I feel, you know, I'm also a healer. I think of myself as a healer, and I think all of them are related.
Very much. It feels to me. Wow. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you always wanted to be a mother. I did read this in your bio. Yeah, it caught my attention. I actually wrote it down here. So I guess a question that comes to mind, I interview a lot of mothers, and especially what is to be a mother? So I have asked the question of what is to be a good mother? Are there guidelines? Within that context, what is to be a good person? So talk to me for a moment about that. You know, what is to be a good mother? What is to be a good person? I would love to hear that from you.
I think to be a good mother is, you know, obviously it's the, especially it sort of changes developmentally, you know, as the child grows, but most fundamentally it's a base of security and love and trying to meet the child where they are and understand their interior world so that you can, you know, help them get where they want to be. I'm very much about helping or like thinking about children as very, you know, independent beings that, you know, that we are here to help, you know, sort of blossom, but that we in no way should control that blossoming, you know. So that's how I see parenting. And so it comes with a lot of just love and patience and listening and understanding and putting up appropriate boundaries, but like allowing a lot of space for them to, you know, for them to explore their own world and figure out what's important to them.
Oh, I love that. And that sounds very similar to the idea of being a healer. Which is also a guide, right? Not somebody who dictates how one should behave or make decisions. Oh, I love that. And I wonder how, I mean, I just wonder because I don't have the experience, how challenging that might be for parents to guide instead of to tell them what to do and how to behave. What a beautiful this.
It is. I feel like it's been so intuitive for me. And that's just what I realize is would have wanted, sort of. But I think, I mean, there's so much been written about this recently, right? Lots of, you know, John Haidt has done a lot of stuff on this. He was at University of Virginia when I was there. But on just how we, you know, as a culture have just completely overparented our children to the point that, you know, that they don't have a sense of self. They don't know how to individuate. Right. They don't, all those issues. And I see it all the time in my my peers. And it can infuriate me, but I also know that it's part of, you know, it's a lot bigger than what they know. It's so part of our culture, and there's so many reasons that have sort of swung us that way. But so interesting.
So in this case, it's just it takes self-awareness, right, Lisa? Knowing what works and what doesn't work. It goes back to the scientific mind, way of living, So another question I have for you is about the initial questions about mental health. How do you define mental health these days?
As you know, we are having a huge mental health crisis. And it's very concerning, especially among our young people, our adolescents and young adults. And, you know, I can name a couple huge factors that I think play into it, but social media, you know, personal cell phones, overparenting, COVID. I think mental health is a multifactorial phenomenon that is affected by, you know, our society we're in, and societal influences and things that are going on, you know, going on, at the family that we're in and what, you know, environmental conditions we're in, you know, and, or the, I guess, domestic situation we're in. And then, you know, sort of biological, factors that are real, and that are more, pronounced in some, you know, mental illnesses than other. But I think the big, you know, rises in mental health are in depression, anxiety, trauma, you know, and things that are much more, I think, a consequence of the huge environmental, societal problems and conflicts going on right now, you know.
Wow. So it's all interconnected, everything.
It's all interconnected,
We all affecting one another.
Yeah.
I remember for me, because it was, I had the experience, sadly, of childhood abuse. So it was, it started with questioning why people would behave that way in a violent way to children, would abuse one another. That didn't make sense to me. So I was always trying to find the answer to that question. Why do we hurt one another unnecessarily? And because I was very young, I had no idea. I didn't have language and I didn't have enough information to know that what my parents did came from conditionings, programs that they had, traumas that they had too. So we're just affecting, passing on their legacy of pain without even being aware of. So but for me, was spirituality was the way, the path to find the answers that I have now, that I have had for quite some time. And I see, I have read and I have talked to people here about young people having this the same kind of it's a mentality that I used to have, mindset that I used to have, that, you know, I wished or I believed that everything should have been different, or I had this belief system that life was just out of sync, disconnected. And so that was really something that was delusional, really, because it was trying to change reality and to make the world a completely different place for my own sake, I guess. So, and I heard that that's what young people do a lot. They are just very dissatisfied with what's happening. They don't understand why so much violence and why parents, they treat them the way they do. And they don't have language to communicate their feelings. They just kind of, I guess it was what I did. I just kind of internalized everything. And then I became depressed. And then I had suicidal thinking and all that. So I guess the question for you is, what's your view of life from a spiritual perspective? Because I'm asking this question because that has been my way of clarity, my way of peace, inner peace. Mm-hmm. So talk to me for a moment about the purpose of life, even if you can throw that in there, Lisa, from the perspective.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think this is all sort of things that, right, I've come to sort of over the years, and it's not, I think I sort of wished I had more spirituality in my life when I was younger. I think that would have been really helpful, but it's something I developed later, and that has been really grounding for me. But, and I guess I'm sort of a mishmash of things that make sense to me, but sort of like more Eastern and Buddhist of, you know, that good things happen and then bad things happen and good things happen and bad things happen. And then there's the, you know, we sort of walk in the middle and all you have can, you know, you can do is just sort of walk a good life, you know, do what you can do to give back and contribute and, you know, and love and all those things. And so I think, like you said, like sort of that having, and then I think that the notion of that we all are the same and that we all have the same needs and desires is a big part of the way I think about things. I think it helps. It really is a part of, informs the way I relate to my, all of my clients, all the people I meet, you know, on the street, to everyone. We all just want to be loved. We want to love, we want to connect and, you know, we want to make a difference somehow. And, I think that's part of, and so I think those kind of guiding lights have been really helpful for me, over the last 10 years when things have really been hard for our family.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's a beautiful way of seeing reality. Yes, that we all share the same desire to be happy, to be loved, to be at peace. That's so true, though. If we ask everyone in the world,
Like safety and security, right?
Yes.
Yes.
But even the idea of safety, it's to get to that, the experience of peace, of happiness, isn't it?
Yes, for sure.
Being safe too, right? To experience happiness and love. Yes, ultimately, that's what we really, all of us want. And, you know, this is one of the ways I see reality. So we all connected, but even worse than that, we're just sharing this one let's say absolute reality, consciousness, God. Mm-hmm. It's not even that God is in everyone. It's that everyone is in God. Only God exists. Mm-hmm. So that just changed. It's interesting, changed everything, but at the same time, it didn't. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't change the world, but it changed the way I see the world. You know, I see people. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that changed the world because it's the only world that I can claim that I own. It's the one here. I can't really live anyone else's world. So in a way, change the world in that sense, when we see life as love from the lens of everything is God. You see, even the word God, I refused to use it for so long because it felt so heavy with this, you know, belief systems, faith in all that religion.
Right.
And I tried not to use it, but then I can't find another word that has this direct a felt understanding of what is trying to be expressed here, you know, that God is the only thing that exists. Like some people say, only love exists.
Right.
The ultimate reality is love, and that would be God.
Right.
So, gosh, I wish I knew this before, of course, when I was going through all the challenges.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then for the young people and anyone else, because even my family, I see that with my husband. He doesn't understand when I say that. Of course, I'm not saying that because I learned from Vedanta. It's something that it resonated with me when I came across this philosophy. Wait a minute, just intuitively feels connected. That's it. Yeah, it's almost like they found the language for me. Okay, I couldn't say that, but
now
you did
it. Is. Yeah, now I have that feeling a lot. Yes, exactly.
Yes. So, one more question for you, the initial questions, Liz, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course.
How do you make sense of suffering? some people say that we are here to learn lessons. So we come and we go through all these challenges to learn something, to evolve as an evolution of the soul, per se. Mm-hmm. But how do you how would you describe what suffering is, and is there a purpose to suffering?
Ooh, I'd love to hear your answer to that, because I don't feel like I have a very good answer to it. I think it's really challenged me. I think if you think that this is the life we know right now, but this is part of something much bigger. I when I think about suffering, and of course I'm going to go back to my daughter, you know, think about clients and that kind of thing. Like, it was clear to me that Maddie was not made to be in this world. Like this world was not the world that she was supposed to be in. And that was like pretty early on. And when I talked to other mothers who had children that were like really psychiatrically ill, like Maddie had a serious eating disorder. And I think they say something similar, you know? And I think in that way, like, yeah, I don't know if it's what needs to happen now for the next life. And those are the things I don't understand, but I don't think I always understand suffering. And I, you know, I feel like some people, for whatever reason, are dealt a lot harder things than others for no reason other than who they happen to be or something, you know?
Mm. Yes. Wow. Yeah. I know that's one of my favorite topics. trying to, because has been, I always wanted to be, I guess I wanted to smile more and kind of be more open to this experience called life. Mm-hmm. I wanted to express, you know, this body, mind in a joyful way. That was really what something in me was looking for. Mm-hmm. But because of the traumas and all the experiences I had, it was the body, mind had. It was not easy. Mm-hmm. So I guess when I came to the understanding that suffering, it's different from pain, because pain and pleasure, it's part of the human experience.
Right.
We cannot deny that. But there's something about holding on to pain, in a sense of holding on to experiences from the past. That's one. Being too, let's say, believing that we are the mind, for example, thoughts and memories. Mm-hmm. I think that was one of the big ha-ha moments for me. Like, wait a minute, I'm not my thoughts. And that it created that distance, so I could really see, wait a minute, I am something that is aware of thoughts, mm-hmm. of memories, of the body. Mm-hmm. So the body's not aware of me, the one that's looking at it and thinking about it, of the body. So I'm aware of everything that is here, so I must be that. That's exactly what I am. So that was always intuitively was my idea, this concept, but I couldn't have language for it. So when I came to Vedanta, that's how they explained it so clearly to me. I mean, not to me, to everyone who knows Advaita Vedanta, that suffering, it's coming from ignorance, ignoring our true self, that essence that never dies, that never changes, that actually was never really, was never born. Really, you can never die for that reason, because it was never born. So what has been born was the body. So the body, that's the thing. We just believe that we're the body because something that, you know, it's so, it feels so real. And it does, but it's not that thing, it's not entirely real because it comes and goes. Thoughts, it's not permanent. So that's my understanding. Suffering has a lot to do with belief systems, believing in something that we are not. Mm. So believe that we're the body, believe that we're the content of the mind, that creates suffering. Mm-hmm. And then joy just arises naturally when we, it's beyond words even. It's not even gratitude, it's beyond gratitude. It's like a gift. It feels like a gift to experience this. And I don't know exactly why, but because I know pain and pleasure belongs to this realm, but it feels that way. There's it feels like gratitude, but I think it's beyond that. I think it's unconditional love, Lisa. That's what it is.
Yeah.
That feeling. And then suffering, I don't think they can coexist, suffering and unconditional love. They don't go together. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but that's how live it.
Yeah, no, it does make sense. Of course, I have a lot of questions about that, but that would be a whole, like, could go all the way into that.
We'll have another interview for that.
Yeah, right.
Oh, but you have,
I guess, something very, I guess, just off the top, being a clinical psychologist, you know, suffering and what'd you say, and love, or what was the other word you said? Suffering.
Unconditional
love. Yeah. Can't coexist, then we wouldn't have these, right, these kids who have, like, you know, very supportive parents go off the rails, and that happens. That happens all the time. Right. And so that seems like that doesn't fit to me, unless I'm not understanding it totally.
So I guess unconditional love, just being clear with that, it's really freedom. It's the idea, the concept again of freedom. I guess from a human perspective, it's not easy to, it should, because it makes so much sense. What we are, it's free. It's something that's completely free. Let's say the substance that's everywhere. That's everything. It's completely free to be anything. Mm-hmm. So in that, it is love. That's how I connect them. Because love will not discriminate, will not push away anything, mm-hmm. Try to make anything wrong or right. Mm-hmm. So it's all about embracing everything as it is. Mm-hmm. And in this case of humans, it's the experience. So the mind, for some reason, we have become almost like so blindly attracted to the idea that we are the body, mind only. And then that's where the suffering, it can happen all the time. I think we have no way out, actually, once you believe and you feel that you are the body, mind only. So now everything, because we know thoughts, they come and go all the time. Right. It's not stable. It's not a stable environment. And the body too, there's always something happening at that level. So it's never stable again. So if we really believe that we are those, these elements, you know, these aspects of being, then that really creates the recipe for suffering. It's unavoidable. But once you realize that you are the body, mind's happening in you, that's the reality. It's almost like a body, and then now you have all the cells and the organs with functions and all, but it's just part of the body, and you are the body. You're not a specific cell or the heart. You are actually everything. But you see, there's something about looking from the awareness perspective that I am aware of, so I cannot be what I'm aware of.
Right.
I guess that's what really, it's very scientific to me.
Yeah.
And the only thing that gets us not to realize that as truth is because we are conditioned to believe that we are the body, mind only. Mm-hmm. And we live in those realms. Mm-hmm. We're always reacting to what's happening in the body, what thoughts are coming. So, I mean, we can't be happy. It's impossible to be joyful, to be peaceful, if we live in those realms. It's like living in inside of a blender. How can you ever, we'll talk in a moment about being broken. That's really a good way of being really broken in lots of pieces, you know, feeling that way, because the mind and body, that's how I see it, almost as a blender. And in its force, sometimes it goes, you know, the full speed, very in high velocity. So that's mental illnesses. I think that's, I would say there's a blender high, and then the highest speed that we can operate that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense to you, but that's how I see it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think that's an interesting way to see it. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, it's different, right? But wow, Lisa, to me, that's just is. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. That's
Yeah. And living from that is just, it changes everything. Like I said, change this world here. It might not change out there, but that's not my, you see, because it's love, it's freedom. So it's not really something that I'm not here to change anything.
Right.
But just to kind of be aware of what's happening here within the body, mind, and then who knows, maybe people will change because of it, but not because I'm trying to. that, right. change them.
Right.
So I love the quotes, change the subject. Maybe we're going a little bit too much. There'll be another interview, right, in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
Spirituality and Vedanta. I love the quotes they have on your website and the words to live by. Mm-hmm. You quoted Viktor Frankl, of course, between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies... In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Mm-hmm. I guess I love that word freedom. So I mm-hmm. saw that. That caught my attention immediately. Mm-hmm. Did you read his book, A Man Searching for Meaning?
Yes, I did. I find his words really powerful, for sure. And that quote, just for me, sort of encapsulates a lot of what plagues humans, you know, is not taking that space and learning, and what you're saying of, you know, having that sort of true self, or that, you know, that in being able to be an observer and saying, and feeling and learning, you know, in your body, what's going on, like feeling those feelings go through it and being able to name it in real time and say, I'm not in any place to make any response right now, but, you know, take some breaths and, like, you know, all those things that we hopefully learn to do as we become young adults and adults. But yeah, that is what gives us our freedom, to be able to actually start to being able to choose. Because before that, we're not choosing anything. It's just happening. Things are happening.
Mm. Yes, right. We're just reacting. Some say, reacting. Right, there's a difference between reaction and in the response.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I love that, though. The word freedom, as I said, caught my attention. Of course, that makes sense to me from the perspective of almost psychological practice, or just practicing. But it goes, for me, it goes beyond practice. Is the realization that I am free already. I am what I'm looking for. So there's nothing that can really disturb that ground. And that really, I mean, of course, sometimes I give in to the body when I have pain, something happens in the body. And it's just interesting to just feel it, you know, go through the sensation. Ah, it's just interesting. It becomes almost like it's a fun thing, because then when you see that it's just an experience, you just kind of, it changes everything. Yes. And you're not really fighting it. You're just kind of going with it.
I agree.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. I agree. And to go into it with just like a curiosity about it, you know, and rather than the hardwired responses.
Right. I think about food, you know, trying different foods. Mm-hmm. Some of them we like, some of them we don't. The sour, the bitter. But it's just a sensation, isn't it? Just trying something new. And that's what this seems to be all about. If we are here already, not that I would want to come back, if there's such a thing as reincarnation, I'll choose not to, probably. But while I'm here, I just want to find, you know, what's the way that I can enjoy this in a meaningful way, of course. That's interestingly enough, that's exactly what happens. Once you realize what you are, your essence, it becomes a lot more fun, everything. And it's just amazing. You don't take anything seriously seriously anymore.
Right. Exactly. There's some humor in everything, which is actually what in my therapy. I watch a ton of stand-up comedy. It's as my kids would say, it's one of my obsessions.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. So I like to go see it live. I watch it on Netflix. I love it, and I have but to me, it's you have to have humor about, you know, your own stuff. And it, you know, and that is about having the space from your stuff to be able to say, this is what's going on here, and this is how it's getting in your way. Right. And, you know, and to be able to have that sort of humility and is so great. It's such a great, sort of process. So.
Yes. I love that you used the word humility. That's, to me, I connect that to that idea, the concept of being humble, to being wise, wisdom.
Yes,
there's
absolutely
something about that.
I agree.
So, oh my God, let's talk about Kintsukuroi, if I can pronounce that correctly, if I did. So this is the Japanese ancient art that... This actually was supposed to be the main topic of the conversation. I just went on with all these questions. I apologize. Mm-hmm. So Talk to me how you came across this concept and how does it relate to you? Of course, I have an idea we talked about in the Reddit, mm-hmm. but for the audience, we would love to hear that, Lisa.
Sure. So to give some backstory, about 5 or 6 years ago, my family kind of, I married my sort of really broad brush strokes, but I married my college sweetheart. We were married for 27 years and had 4 kids and did lots of things really well and did lots of things right. And then about 5 or 7 years ago, there was, I think sort of a midlife crisis, but whatever, big explosion, our family blew up and it was devastating for everybody. And it was very unexpected. And my oldest child, Maddie, had already had a pretty significant eating disorder. And to be honest, and this is another thing that we could spend a whole segment of time on. She also had had pre-existing really significant anxiety and OCD as well. So the eating disorder got this very like fertile soil to like dig its claws in. Anyway, so my ex-husband leaving the family and doing this really caused her to go downhill and then COVID hit and she crashed and our family got more sort of disconnected. And then very sadly, my daughter passed away from heart failure due to her eating disorder. And it was in that moment that my ex and all of us said, everything that's happened before doesn't matter. We as a family are the most important people in each other's lives. Mm-hmm. And we have, and we did everything to make that, our values before this happened. And we're going to go back, we're going to reform ourselves and become that family again. And never, ever let go sight of that importance of these relationships. And so that's where that came from. And right after Maddie passed away, we all got tattoos of a Kintsukuri. Kintsukuri, all sort of different. So it's been really meaningful to us. We have a Kintsukuri group text that we text on probably about 8 or 10 times a day. Just thoughts that come up for any of us and that we want to sort of share with the rest of us. So it's a pretty powerful bond. Yeah, it's pretty.
How beautiful. That is the title of this episode. I title it, If You Approve It.
I love
The Beauty
that.
Of Love. Yeah, The Beauty of Love, Our Most Powerful Agent in Healing.
Oh, I love that so much. That's perfect.
Yeah, The Beauty of Love. For some reason, it just came to me. I was inspired by that, by your story. So you mentioned something else that caught my attention, Lisa, that was in your bio, the topic that you sent to me, right? You said, we do not know how to treat serious eating disorders, and the programs we currently have are wholly inadequate and flawed. Talk to me for a moment about that. Why do you feel this way? If you still do.
And I really do. and they say like, and I need to put in the caveat that they're really, and I was told this really early, in my training, actually. It's very ironic because I did my training at Children's Hospital in Denver, and one of my, early mentors was a specialist in eating disorders, and Maddie was 2 years old when I started the training. And I, of course would never imagine she would develop eating disorder, but she said to me, a third of people who develop eating disorders sort of totally recover and go on, and it never really plays a significant role in their lives. A third of people, recover, but it continues to sort of plague them and sort of comes up and down depending on stressors in their lives. It never really goes away, but it becomes part of them. And then a third actually die. And it's, the highest mortality of any of the psychiatric disorders. And so I'm really talking about this top third. I think for the others, I think a lot of the eating disorder programs are actually probably pretty effective. They use a lot of CBT methods and, ACT methods and family therapy, but they're very cookie cutter. I don't think they do enough. I don't think they look at each individual well enough. I don't think that they, I think there's a lot of sort of punitive biases around families and parents that are implicit in the programs. And so I think, I wasn't impressed with them. I didn't see actually a lot of recovery happening for my daughter and them. So for my daughter and the ones that become really intractable, and for think there are a variety of reasons why for her it was so hard, I don't think we're doing a good job. I think we can't even scratch the surface. We're not scratching the surface. And that's when, and that's how actually my family and I have gotten into sort of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, which I think, but is probably, it's very promising right now. Some of the early results we're looking at in terms of at least pushing the dial a little bit for some of these young women and men who just really struggle with this disorder and really can't let go of it.
Right. That was my follow-up question, about psychedelic-assisted therapy, if that would. Do you believe that that could have helped Maddie?
Yes. So I'm glad you asked that, actually. I really do. I really, really, truly do. And I think that's one of the most heartbreaking and bittersweet things is my next oldest daughter, Emma, went to Johns Hopkins, and there's a lab at Johns Hopkins at the was one of the sort of NIH sites for looking at psilocybin assisted psychotherapy with anorexia. And so we all got Maddie onto the wait list, and in the process of that, got to know the PI on the study. Her name is we call her Dr. G. It's Natalie Gukosian, and we've become good friends with her, and she now has moved to Colombia, but she's done some really pivotal research with anorexic young women. She has about 20 in her cohort that have really struggled and have really treatment resistant, and has found some really positive and exciting findings that are going to come out soon. A real 50% of them actually had real change in their relationship to the eating disorder, like a real sort of epiphany around, don't want to live this anyway. And I'm not going to live this way anymore. I think for Maddie, she, like we always said at the end, like she needed a brain reset. She literally needed to be rebooted.
Right.
And I think psilocybin could have really helped with that.
Yes. So. Yeah. Yes. Thank you for confirming that. Right. I talk to a lot of therapists who use psychedelic as therapy, and I have done it myself too. I have tried. And
me as well. Yeah. So helpful.
Yes. It's really amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh. Yeah. So we're still outdated, right, Lisa, when it comes to that, the medical, the mental health system model.
Yeah. So outdated. And, I now offer ketamine-assisted psychotherapy in my office. But I think we're moving all in the right direction. It was just Maddie was a little too, it was too early, a little too early, just like a year or two early,
Lisa, you have something to say.
I was going
to
say, it was going on. I mean, that's one of the other heartbreaking things. It was going on underground, and I wasn't aware of it. Until I was aware of it, you only know what you know, right? And so I actually met a woman, really wonderful woman named Adela France, who was leading underground psychedelic journeys with really sick anorexic women, and was really making differences. So I wish I had met her about a year earlier,
Right. Yes. I was about to say that too. I think we're not supposed to say that here, but the underground, right, works.
Yeah.
Like we see even with, I think you called them the... Ayahuasca, the churches of psychedelics, there's so many. In Florida, I live in Florida, is one close by. Anyone can do that.
Anyone can.
Right. It's really a matter of, again, knowledge, right? Knowing how the mind operates and what can be done. And that's why I always go back to that, the idea of ignorance. It's not in a pejorative way, but it's in a way of not knowing. So once when we don't know, then we come from ignorance, and we don't do enough. We can't really do much, really, about certain things because we don't know.
Right.
I remember, I think, you know, a lot of people, when it comes to spirituality, they say things like, oh, it was meant to happen. Whatever happened was meant to happen, or it's God's will, wish, whatever it is. You know, that's something that never resonated. I always go back to the idea of not knowing. Of course, we all lose the body in the end, but there's something about suffering that it can be avoided. It really can. It really, really can. I think that came to me, it was, I remember somebody asked a question to one of the spiritual teachers, Swamis, that I know of. And he said about the World Trade Center, why that happened. And then that was the answer. That's not really, it was not something that, you know, was meant to happen. And it's part of freedom because God, it's free. It's something that, I mean, anything can happen here. But we are really seeing, that's the face of ignorance, of fear, of not knowing. Mm-hmm. Violence, the wars that we see now. People killing
for sure.
That's not coming from freedom. It's coming from something else.
Right.
Oh my God. So let me see the other questions that I have here for you. Something that caught my attention too. Oh yeah, we talked about this. I'm going through my notes just to make sure I didn't miss anything. Oh yes, Lisa, you are working on writing a memoir. Yeah, that's one of my notes here. So, and I know you have, you have a title for it, a working title for it already. It seems to me, right? Yeah. So I would love to hear about that.
Yeah. So I, my working title is Willful Blindness. And I don't know why that's what, you know, like you said, like I am sort of an into it. So things sort of come to me and they just fit so well. I don't know why, you know, so, it refers. Yeah. So I guess really quickly, my mother had a really severe mental illness. She had really severe bipolar 1 disorder. And basically from age 8 on, she was dysfunctional and not able to parent at all. So I was left with a dad who was a very high achieving academic, long-term professor at University of Chicago, who had no interest in raising me. And then he married a woman who had even less interest in raising me and just was extremely neglected, but in ways that were very dangerous at times. So then I also was sort of traumatized in other ways because I just, no one was watching, you know?
Right.
Oh yeah. So to get back to the question, can you ask the question again? I totally lost it in that. I probably dissociated or something. What was the question?
Sorry. Yes. Yeah. What is it about? And then I'm just kind of picturing everything here because I am very empathic, so I'm kind of can visualize you growing up, you know, the confusion and suffering.
And so I was very alone. My dad did not know how to talk about feelings, and I had a mother that was really mentally ill, and I was supposed to go visit her every other weekend. I had an older brother who refused to go, so I would go on my own and have to sort of parent her and see her like just not, you know, just not functioning, not so depressed, like. You know, and it was it was pretty terrible. And I felt very responsible for her because she had no one else in her life. And then I'd come home and my dad wouldn't ask about it. And if I did say anything, he said, why are you even worrying about her? Like, it's not you shouldn't be worrying about it. It's not her problem, you know, your problem.
Wow.
So like, doesn't have any support around it. So, and I think like my experience, I just wanted to not believe that was my life. And so in terms of willful blindness, I basically pretended it wasn't. And so I had a best friend I will say, like, I sometimes like thank her for saving my life because I met her when I was 10, right? When my family was, my mother sort of broke apart when I was 8. My dad decided to leave the whole shebang when he was, you know, when I was 10. And then I met Susan, thank God. And so I spent all my time over there. So I saw that there was actually what I thought family should look like. And and I think that gave me like just so much normalcy. But she, and like now we're still extremely good friends. She did not know what was going on in my house. Like I would not share that. It was as if it weren't going on. So the willful blindness was like, I just pretended that wasn't happening. And I had all the trappings of being able, you know, I was attractive. I had lots of friends. Like I went to a good college. Like it looked like everything was great from the outside, you know, so no one really knew. And I felt so alone and so isolated and so lonely deep down, right? And I wished I had realized there were other people in the world that had families like that, because I really didn't think there were. And so I think that's early on. And then also, like, when you have a really mentally ill parent, I think we're probably going over time, but I'll say, when you become a young adult, you really worry you're going to become like your parent. It's like a very ubiquitous thing. I've had it with my own clients a lot, and it's, you know, lots of research on it. So that process is excruciating, becoming a young adult and being like, when is it going to happen to me? Right. Yeah. And then I finally got through that. Like, it's not going to happen to me. And then having the same experience when you have kids of, is it going to happen to one of my kids? And then having a daughter that I could tell, being an intuit and being so, you know, and also being well-trained in psychology, I could tell early on is like, she was honestly like one of the most stunning children and young adults and, you know, all the way through, stunning, beautiful, so smart in every way. But I could tell, like, she is different and the world is hard for her. Like, she was, you know, she was scared of the world. So I wish I could have read a book like mine. So I think that going into having a parent that had a mental illness, and then seeing that, and then feeling like all I have to do, so that really struck me, all I have to do is love this child enough, right? And somehow I can undo what my mother did, because my mother had a really terrible childhood. So I was like, if I can only give my child what my mother didn't have, and my mother might have had that gene or whatever it is, you know, I cannot let that happen. But then you realize, you know what, you know, the whole, like, you know, serenity prayer, you can't change everything. There are things you don't have power over. And this was something I learned pretty early, which was excruciating, that I didn't have a lot of power over.
Right.
And that was awful. So anyways, I feel like my story would help a lot of people. And so I feel this sort of drive to want to write it. And it's just more about finding the time to do it. But I've written parts of it. Yeah.
Oh, you have already. Okay.
I've written you know, I have a sort of chapter outline and that kind of stuff. So.
Yes. Yeah. That sounds like a beautiful contribution to humanity. That's what we need, really, to help one another. If there was a purpose for this life, it would, to me, would be that, to help one another, to find the peace, the love, the happiness that we spoke earlier. So you're already doing that, Lisa, by having this interview today. But that would be amazing, too, if you can have the book out there. Please let me know when it's published.
I will absolutely.
I'll keep you accountable. Actually, I'm going to email you about that from time to time. How's the book going?
Yes. Keep me on my toes as we get to me.
Yes. How amazing. Thank you so much for being you, for your presence in this reality. Thank you
so much for asking me to be here. And thank you so much for you being you here. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I love this. What can I say? You know, it's been, has been said that in the end, that's when we realize it's just a story, then this whole thing about experiences here, that's when real peace really sets in, when we know it's just a story. Yeah. And now we live in it, so we can't really detach from it. It's still a living story, but... that would be amazing for all of us to realize that it's just a wonderful experience of pleasure and pain being here, but not suffering. I really wish for all of us to find that peace in what we are, so we don't suffer anymore. But with that in mind, Lisa, I have to ask you this question before we end the conversation for today. What three experiences you wish everyone to have before they die?
I mean, I don't know if you're looking for something so basic as, you know, to love and to be loved, you know,
Like
certainly, you know, not, and you think that's so basic, but not everyone, certainly not everyone has that. And so I wish, you know, I think if everyone had that as a basis, we'd all be so much better as a humankind, right? If we were just given those very basic needs, you know, I'm also, you know, attachment theorist. So I think, you know, like that just being here is enough, that just being you is enough. And being told that and by every action, you know, early on, you know, is that is such a gift to be given. It affects everything else that's, you know, in your life, about how just the ease of how you will go through your life, you know.
Right. Ah, beautiful. Yes. Yeah. A billion times to that truth. Yes.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to add to those that comes to mind?
I don't think so. I think we've covered it.
Yeah. That's a beautiful ending, right? If we can just know that we are it, right? That we are what we are looking for. That's
it. Right.
Feeling fulfilled and already complete. I always go back to that, feeling whole, always feeling whole. Mm-hmm. It's just such an amazing feeling, if it is a feeling. And for me, it's coming from deep understanding, felt understanding. Yeah. But I know it can become a feeling in the body too, right? Why not?
Yes,
that I am complete. So thank you so much again, Lisa. And I'll have the website there. So drlisabillings.com. That will be on the podcast notes. And we'll be in touch again. I would love to be in touch again.
I would love that too.
Yeah. Absolutely. Take good care and we'll talk soon.
Bye. Sounds good. All right. Take care. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about Dr. Billings and her work, please visit drlisabillings.com.
To learn more about this podcast, please visit fitforjoy.org/podcast. Thank you again for listening, and bye for now.